This is Bach Talk. The audience quiets. An elegant woman appears from a side door. She glides across the front of the stage. The audience applauds, and she acknowledges with a brief bow. She turns to face the performers. The oboist plays an A. The orchestra begins to tune. She offers a beautiful, glowing smile to the players. They see it and mirror the sentiment. She takes her seat in the front row, the concertmaster's chair. The stage is set, the anticipation real, the electricity in the room palpable. The concert is about to begin. Something amazing is about to happen. Is this person who merits such a view from the front row? What is her role exactly? What makes her tick? What makes her laugh? Today, let's meet the concertmaster of the Bach Society of St. Louis Orchestra for nearly a quarter century, violinist Lenora Maria Anna. Hello, I'm Ron Clem. Welcome to Bach Talk. In the next little while, we'll learn all about Dr. Lenora Anup, her musical beginnings, her approach to teaching, her full circle moments, and her experiences with the Bach Society Orchestra and Chorus. However, we wanted to begin with something completely different. A wonderful cellist happened to hear Lenora play Bach in Italy some time ago and asked her to become a member of InterHarmony, an international music festival. A collaboration was born. More about that straight ahead. When we got together a few months ago, Lenora had just returned from New York and a triumphant concert with this chamber music group. Bach Society Music Director Dennis Sparger joined the conversation in the Mello Family Library at Ladue Chapel in St. Louis. And, considering the timing, the first question pretty much asked itself. I've been dying to ask you a question, and now it's very apropos.
Okay.
How do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Practice, practice, practice.
Or you get on a plane and you go and play with?
I performed as part of the InterHarmony festival series there, and I performed with a cellist, Misha Quint, who's an internationally renowned soloist, and a pianist who flew in from Rome. Wow. For the concert, so it was...
And how did you connect with these people? Chamber music requires this incredible sense of ensemble, and if you don't see them all the time, that must be tough then.
It is. You're right. It's something that when I'm preparing for these concerts, you have to prepare in so many different ways because you don't know. I hadn't played with a pianist before, so I listened to a bunch of his recordings and just tried to get to know him as much as I could in person before we met. But I think chamber music, there's such an immediacy with it, and it's like us sitting here having a conversation.
Intimate.
Very, very. And, you know, you say something, and then one responds, and then...
Well, it's quite one thing, you know, sitting and talking with a few people you've known for a very long time, and you know they're going to say pleasant things. You can anticipate a lot. But with two people you haven't played with before, and then to make it come together so glued so tightly, just an amazing feat.
Yes. It, yeah. It causes me a little anxiety beforehand.
No.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well. But it's amazing. It's when you're there playing, and actually afterwards we had a standing ovation, and we played a movement of a Mendelssohn trio for the encore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing when people take liberties, maybe with a little retard here,
yes,
a little movement there, and especially when you have interlocking 16th notes, and it's really remarkable.
Now, this is not your first chamber music rodeo. I mean, you've done this a few times.
I've done it a few times.
How did you get connected with this particular group?
I've been performing and teaching at a festival in Italy, and it's called the Inner Harmony Music Festival. And it's in this beautiful little town in northern Italy called Acqua Terme. And so I met Misha Quint, the cellist, is the music director of the festival. And he heard me play, and we became acquainted, and then he invited me to come.
We're so thrilled that you had this opportunity, and now you're back on Earth with us.
I really appreciated your support.
Did you have much rehearsal time on stage?
No, we had very little, about 50 minutes.
But you've played Carnegie Hall before.
Yeah.
So you knew that, you at least knew the experience, what that would be like in that room.
Right. Because
the first time you go in there, whoa.
Yeah, that certainly helps.
I've been to Carnegie Hall too, but I had to buy a ticket. let's talk about the Bach Society and about your role as concert master. When did you come to the Bach Society in that role?
I remember this very clearly. It was for a concert in the spring of 2000, and it was for the Bach B minor Mass.
Yes.
And I had about 7 or 6 days notice.
Mm-hmm. We had someone who was lined up to play, who then received an offer, I think, from the Minnesota Orchestra to come and play. And, of course, bye-bye.
Yeah.
And you understand this is kind of how it happens.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And we were very fortunate to find that there was an outstanding player, teacher at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. And our contractor made the call. And, well, we have been delighted ever since. One of the things that really struck me in the first rehearsal is Lenora's interest in fixing every little detail in the string section. You know, I would ask for something, she would translate it, and all the other players would
understand.
Wait a
minute, you have to translate it?
We have to translate, yes, yeah.
Into the language of strings, maybe?
Exactly.
Yes, yeah.
So that brings up this question. You have really two leaders. You are a leader in the string section, but he's the maestro.
Right.
So how does that dynamic work? Explain that to me.
She just does what I tell her.
Well, that's...
yes, exactly.
Since none of the rest of us do.
Well, you know, every concert, we have rehearsals together. But before those rehearsals start, Dennis and I are corresponding frequently over months.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, I'll call him and say, hey, could you take a look at this movement and tell me what is your thought about the phrasing here? And because I need to articulate my phrase with the soprano soloist or the choir for this. And, you know, what is the shape that you're doing? What is your articulation and where are you breathing so I know where I need to breathe?
Yeah, and it's just amazing you do this without benefit of the full score in front of you when you're preparing.
Well, sometimes I find the full score online, or I'll go to the university library and get it.
That's how you do it. Mm. Yes. And of course, you have the experience of having done so many of the major works in your past.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which of the works are the most memorable for you as you sit here with us right now? Obviously, it's got to be B minor is right up there.
St. Matthew Passion, the Brandenburg Concerti. I can't tell you. I don't have one because they're all incredible pieces of me and my past and my future.
Whatever you're working on at the moment.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
You put your whole heart and being.
Completely.
But the pieces you mentioned were all by Bach. Do you approach Bach differently than you approach other composers?
I haven't asked myself that specific question, but I think, I guess the answer is yes, in a way. When I was young and just, you know, starting, and I'm talking high school, college, my mother was a beautiful contralto, and she was singing oratorios, and so I was, you know, aware of Bach. I didn't feel at peace with it for the longest time.
How so? What does that mean?
I grew up in a vocal household, first of all. Not a strings household.
I'm sorry to hear that.
So I'm not. I'm thrilled about it. I also think that's probably why we do so well together, because that is my foundation. I was trained more in a kind of the romantic Russian school of violin playing, which was very, very de rigueur, you know, back in the last century. I don't want to say how old I am, but that's when I trained. And everything was very sustained with a bow. Everything was very highly vibratoed with the left hand. It was all very connected, and it's fascinating to me when I look back to the Bach score of the six. It's a collection of sonatas and partitas. There's six, but there are three of each for violin. Solo violin,
no other instrument.
Yes, solo violin, and those are really the foundation works for violinists. When I look back to the book that my teacher had me get, I think it was copywritten maybe in 1979, 80, and the fingerings are very Galamian was the major violin pedagogue who did this edition. And coming out of this tradition of extreme romanticism, he had a lot of fingerings going up and down one string and high positional work and string crossings in higher positions. So that really, I didn't know this at the time, but it was all to have the most sustained sound and the most vibrato possibilities. But over the decades, with all of the research that's been done since that time, now we know that, you know, open strings are A-okay. And the vibrato should be used very sparingly as an ornamentation, not as a just you turn it on and it keeps going. So over the decades, I've reworked my thinking for Bach and my understanding. And as soon as I did that, then it was like, okay, I'm comfortable. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
A I big could. Big door opens.
Yes.
Yes.
And then it started to make sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what really changed
everything.
You just
have to uncover all that dust that had gathered over a few centuries.
And make space, silence.
Mm-hmm. Yes. A lot of that scholarship has started happening like by the mid-60s, but it wasn't getting out to such a large degree yet. And it was taking another 10 years, another 10 years, another 10 years before more and more performers started getting the idea that, oh, we need to do some studying too about all of this. I know when I was hearing Bach in the listening room when I was an undergraduate, I could hardly stay awake. It was just so drab. You know, music for a funeral, and yet it's so alive. It dances, it rejoices,
and it's all about the approach to it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I think, and piggybacking on what your idea was when I was doing my graduate work, one student didn't have very good vibrato, and I remember overhearing the teacher saying, "Well, have her play some Baroque music." That really stuck with me because, you know, it was all about developing your vibrato. And now I look back on that and I just think, oh my goodness, you know, by changing your outlook and then changing your technique to fit the period. So going back to your question, how do I prepare for Bach or do I prepare for playing Bach differently than other composers? The answer is yes. Because I think you need to be aware of the period that the composer is from and what the whole package. And that, to me, is remarkable and exciting.
And an amazing product that came out of all of this development is that several years ago, Lenore and I sat and put together our ideas to make a one-page style sheet. About the first two-thirds of the page address singers and players and give them ideas of how to approach notes in different situations. And the final third speaks just directly to string players for what they need to do in bowing to articulate the kinds of things that we're trying to accomplish. And before every performance of a Baroque piece, especially a Bach piece, we send that out again to all the performers so they can be refreshed that this is what we're trying to accomplish. And it opens up the music to give more light, more transparency to the music, and just to bring more of the dance into the sound.
And it's so difficult to, when you think about that list that we made, you'd think it would be very easy to say, well, don't play with any vibrato. But you can't just turn it on or off. You know, there's a cohesiveness about it. And it's not just left hand, it's the right hand with the bow. How do you draw the bow to begin? You know, every note has is not just one part. It has a beginning, an entrance. It has a middle, which is the body of the note. It has the exit of the note. And then it has both sides to those three things, right? And so I think, okay, how do I want to go into this note? What type of articulation? What am I modeling? Am I, you know, in dialogue with a vocalist? Am I in dialogue with the oboe? You know, what's happening here? And then what happens in the middle of the note? Does it grow? What kind of intensity? What, it's not just, okay, go from forte. It's what type of character does that forte sound have? Is it joyous? Is it more fleeting? Is it sorrowful? What is the impetus of the character, of the color of the sound, of the energy of the sound?
It ain't easy, is it?
No.
it calls for a lot of examination, a lot of decision-making to get all these choices down.
Mm-hmm. That's music director Dennis Sparger. We're talking with our concertmaster, the Bach Society of St. Louis Orchestra, Lenora Maria Anup. I'm Ron Clem, and this is Bach Talk. You talked a little bit about this already, but tell us about what life was like in the home. Your earliest recollection of music. You talked about your mother a little bit, and I want to know when somebody put a violin in your hand.
Oh, very early. I was 3 years old, and my mother was a university professor in Denver, voice professor, and she was so anxious to, you know, get me, her only child, involved in music. And she had heard about this program, beginning Suzuki violin, so the Suzuki pedagogy movement. Mm-hmm. And there was a nun by the name of Sister Alice Josephine, who was starting this beginning Suzuki string violin program in the convent, not a couple miles from our house.
Bringing it over to this hemisphere.
She had trained Suzuki pedagogy with a man by the name of John Kendall. Now, I don't know if that name rings a bell.
It certainly does.
But John Kendall was one of two violinists who brought the Suzuki movement from Japan to America back in the 1960s. John Kendall was the violin professor at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville.
How about that?
And in my office, I have a little plaque, and there's a picture of me when I'm 4 years old, and Sister Alice is helping me hold my violin, and it talks about, it was actually at St. Louis Parish in Englewood, Colorado, which I think is kind of interesting, and it says that she studied Suzuki violin with Dr. John Kendall at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. And then in 1997, I became the violin professor there. So my life totally came full circle.
Full circle. Mm. Full circle.
Just amazing. Incredible. Mm-hmm.
So you started with this small violin, right?
Oh, it's small. Yeah, it's an eighth size. Mm-hmm. And I then gave it to my children to play on.
Ah, how about that? Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, there's a full circle for you, too.
Yeah, that is true.
Were you pushed in your development, or did you push yourself?
Early on, it was really my mother pushing me. My father would say, oh, Eleanor, you know, give her a chance to grow up. And practicing was hard. Not when I was really little. It was fun when I was, you know, three, four, five, six. But then, with the Suzuki movement back then, they weren't teaching you how to read music. It was all oral. Mm-hmm. So we'd listen to recordings, and then I would play back what I heard. So I had an incredibly developed ear, mm-hmm. but I wasn't taught to read music. And so my mother, being the university professor, thought, okay, she needs a grounding in how to read music and theory.
Gone, yeah.
That's right. So when I was in elementary school, she had me start taking piano lessons, and I was taking them from a university professor. And she, of course, because of her expectations, she expected me to be able to read music. And
oops.
Exactly. And so I was so frustrated as a child, I ended up quitting both.
Really? Wow.
And
for how long?
It was a good break, probably around a year. And then I felt pretty guilty because my parents had, life wasn't always easy, and my dad had been out of work. And I started feeling terribly guilty that they had spent all this money to get me in lessons and when they needed it for other things, mm-hmm. you know. And so I knew how much it meant because I lived it every day in the house with my mother, you know, teaching and singing and vocalizing. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to do this again. And what we did was we started with a completely different teacher. And I had to go back several years in the sense because I had to catch my reading up to my playing ability. Mm-hmm. And so we just kind of merged everything with a new effort, with a new teacher, with a new structure, and then it really took off.
And the rest is history.
Yeah. Well, yeah, let's talk about that history a minute. So how did you move into from solo playing and ensemble playing, orchestra playing? How did that all happen?
I have always loved all of it. Mm-hmm. And I feel that I'm the luckiest person I know, the luckiest violinist, in that I have a life that's filled with solo playing, with chamber music, with orchestral, with teaching. My life is very exciting, busy, and I am so grateful at all of the opportunities I have, especially, you know, 20 years, 23 years with the Bach Society.
Oh, that old quarter century mark. Yes. Don't we have a celebration when it's quarter century?
Well, no, we don't, but we probably should.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
We could start a tradition.
Yeah.
Me about teaching. Mm-hmm. You've been taught, you've been on the receiving end, and now you're teaching. So do you use similar approaches that were used for you in your teaching of others?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't think there's an easy answer. I have the most wonderful students in the world, every one of my students is unique. And so the way that I feel that I can be the best teacher, the best mentor for them is to get to know them as well as possible, to know, you know, we all have things that are easy for us to do, other things that are challenges. But on top of the physicality of being a player, everyone has emotions and fears. I think being the biggest cheerleader and support in every way for my students. And then, you know, there's a level of trust and relationship. And then you can say, okay, now try this. And then you also know, you learn how the person thinks. And, oh, this person really does well if I explain it, but also demonstrate it. Mm-hmm. Whereas this person, I have to demonstrate 5 different ways, like take every step apart. Or this person, I can just kind of say more generally, and they will understand it and to make it theirs. I don't want all of my students to sound the same. I want them to sound like themselves. So I take every student as, you know, being very individual, and I try to help them grow with their strengths and while, you know, helping them with their shortcomings.
Mm-hmm. We have a mutual friend. His name is Steve Morshak, and he told me recently about a book called Talent is Overrated. It's not a musical book. But it relates to music as well. Yeah. But he talks about Tiger Woods, for example, who is a tremendous golfer. The question that the book addresses is it talent or is it practice? Is a virtuoso violinist born or made? Now, obviously, there's some of both. Mm-hmm. But his point is, it's all about putting in the work.
Yes.
Would you concur?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Can you teach anyone to be a violinist?
I'd like to think the answer is yes, but I do know that some people are just more able than others physically. And I do think that some of that is innate. It's interesting that you bring up the Tiger Woods analogy, because I very much like to think about, for instance, the Olympics with gymnasts. And I think about, you know, how they prepare every single, if they're on a beam, they know how many steps, how they know everything. And they have to do it to such great detail so that they don't injure themselves. And I'm always telling my students, okay, now you need to think like an athlete, an Olympian. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not practicing until you get it right. It's practicing until you can't miss it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Well said.
In addition to concert performances by the Bach Society Orchestra, our musical portions today also featured selections from Bach Unlocked, a scholarly project that took Lenora to not only various concert stages on 2 continents, but also into the recording studio. These are new transcriptions of the great cello suites by Bach, reconfigured for solo violin. It's a project very close to Lenora's heart, and we'll bring her back soon to talk about it. In the meantime, you can order your own copy of Bach Unlocked by violinist Lenora Annup simply by going to bachunlocked.com. It's a must for violinists and teachers alike. That's bachunlocked.com. The associate producer of Bach Talk is Scott McDonald. Marketing and technical assistance provided by Andy Murphy and Carissa Marciniak of The Right Relations. And of course, special thanks to Lenora Annup and to music director Dennis Sparger. Subscribe to Bach Talk wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more at bachsociety.org. Bach Talk is a registered trademark of the Bach Society of St. Louis. I'm Ron Clem.